Welcome to The Bitter Witness.
Don't be scared.
Hello, welcome back. I hope you've had a good week. I've had a busy week. I'm very involved in community theater and we have a production about to open. I'm quite excited about that. If you've ever thought about joining your community theater, you should. There's something for you to do there. Might not be on the stage, but it might be in the background. It's a lot of fun and you meet a lot of new people. So, the dogs are sleeping behind me. Your ASMR today will be brought to you by both Miley and Piper. If you enjoy the show, please head over to our Patreon and support us. For a few dollars a day, you'll get exclusive content called The Bitter Bits. So grab a cup of tea, sit back, relax while I tell you the case of the Footpath Murders. As always, I want to give the victims in this case top billing, Linda and Dawn. I acknowledge you and I send my love to you wherever you may be. This story takes place in Narborough, England. It is the very first case where a murderer was convicted based on DNA evidence. It's also the first case where a suspect was cleared with DNA evidence. Linda Rosemarie Mann was 15 years old in 1983. She was shy and popular, loved to hang out with her friends, and she loved school. On November 21st, 1983, Linda left her home to walk along a footpath known as the Black Pad. She was only going about a mile or so. She was supposed to be babysitting. The Black Pad was a lovely pathway through a forested area that was mainly used by the villagers of Narborough and the nearby village of Enderby. Narborough, England is a quiet village with about 6,000 people. Linda Mann's mother, Kath Eastwood, claims that it was a lovely atmosphere inside the small village, very community. Everyone helped each other. When Linda didn't come home by midnight, her parents called the police. This was quite unlike Linda. Linda would always let her parents know if she was going to be late, and for the most part, she was always home on time. Kath, Linda's mom, stated that they had been up all night hoping that Linda would come through the door. She said that she was looking out the window watching as all the other children were going to school, and she was praying that Linda would come home and just be ready to go to school, that maybe Linda had stayed at a friend's and just forgot to call. But then the police came to the door that morning, asked Kath to sit down, and they just plainly said, "She's dead. We found her." It was that morning, November 22nd, 1983, that a hospital worker riding his bicycle to work found Linda's semi-nude body just off the footpath. Linda's clothing was strewn about her body. Her jeans and underwear had been removed. There was a scarf around her neck, and that was what had been used to strangle her. Linda had also been sexually assaulted. Linda's body had been found only a few hundred yards from a psychiatric hospital. In a small village such as Narborough, news like this traveled very fast. The villagers were horrified at the thought of something so horrible happening to one of their own. They were also worried, especially those with young girls. The majority of the villagers thought that only someone local would know where the Black Pad was, which only increased their fears. Many thought that because Linda's body had been found only a few yards from a psychiatric hospital, that perhaps the killer had been one of the patients who had escaped. A shoulder-to-shoulder search by police of the crime scene turned up little evidence, but the autopsy provided some clues. The autopsy showed that there were no injuries to Linda's body other than the strangulation and the sexual assault. This told the police that it was not a violent attack and that she may have died very quickly. The police and the coroner believed that Linda had been strangled to death and then raped. The autopsy also offered a semen sample from Linda's body. The person who left the sample had type A blood and an enzyme profile titled PGM1. These two factors would match about 10% of the adult male population in England. So PGM1 is an evolutionary enzyme that regulates one of the most important metabolic carbohydrate trafficking points in your body. I don't know what that means. I don't like science. Science is hard. Police questioned thousands of people about Linda, trying to determine some type of a timeline for the night she was killed. They posted thousands of posters with Linda's picture, asking if anyone in the public remembered seeing Linda on November 21st. There were hundreds of leads, and they followed everyone. I have to say that the effort that went into this investigation was tremendous by the police in Narborough. In fact, on the day of Linda's funeral, the police videotaped every person that attended, because sometimes perpetrators will revisit the scene of the crime or some other aspect of the crime. And it isn't unheard of for a perpetrator to attend a large public funeral, such as the one held for Linda. Sadly, nothing came of the police videotaping everyone coming to the funeral. As time passed and the leads began to dry up, Linda's case went cold. A year passed and Linda's parents were interviewed for a news report. Her father stated that they suffered all the time. Linda's mother pleaded to the killer, "Please come forward. They just wanted justice for their daughter." 3 years later, on July 31st, 1986, 15-year-old Dawn Ashworth was walking home from her part-time job at a newsstand. Dawn decided to take a shortcut and use an overgrown footpath known as 10 Pound Lane to the locals. According to police, Dawn had made it about halfway through 10 Pound Lane when a man appeared on the footpath and exposed himself to her. Dawn panicked and ran into a field to get away from the man. But the man followed her, and when he caught her, he grabbed her and held her and began telling her all about himself. My thought here is he was trying to gain sympathy from Dawn and give her a false sense of security. Once he had gotten Dawn to calm down, he attacked her and raped her. When the man was finished raping her, he decided that he had told her too much information and that she would be able to identify him to the police, and because of this, he killed her. When Dawn wasn't home by 9:30 that night, her parents called the police. Immediately, villagers began to pray that this was not a repeat of the Linda Mann case. 2 days later, police searching for Dawn discovered her nude body under some brush. Dawn was found less than a mile from where Linda Mann was murdered 3 years earlier. Like Linda, Dawn had been strangled and raped. However, Dawn's autopsy showed that she had severe injuries to her body and genital areas, indicating that this attack was a very violent one. As well, from the autopsy results, the injuries that Dawn suffered showed that she had fought for her life hard. Semen samples were taken from Dawn's body, and they showed that Dawn's killer had the same blood type as Linda Mann's murderer. This isn't the only similarity between the two murders. Both girls were 15 years old. Both girls were raped and strangled. Both girls were walking alone on a footpath. Both girls were from the same small village of Narborough. They were both found in a similar position, and both girls attended the Lutterworth Grammar School and Community College. As well, both the footpaths that the girls were found on were really only known to those who lived locally. the villagers started to realize all of the similarities between Linda and Don's murders. Fear took over the village. The public were terrified, wondering who would be next, and police advised all school-aged girls to not walk alone anywhere for any reason. In a press statement, Dawn's father stated that he had warned her and warned her about going down a footpath on her own. Her mother stated that they had to find the fiend that did this to her daughter before it happened again. Instantly, the police launched a large-scale investigation into Dawn's death. Now, with two victims, their determination to find this killer became stronger. Again, shoulder-to-shoulder searches were conducted. Thousands of people were interviewed, and within a week, they had a small break in the case. Witnesses came forward stating that they had seen a young man in the area of 10 Pound Lane on the same afternoon that Dawn was murdered. The young man was identified as 17-year-old Richard Buckland. Richard was a kitchen worker at the psychiatric hospital that was only a few yards from where both Linda and Dawn had been murdered. Richard also had some learning disabilities. And when the police interviewed him, he seemed to know certain things about the two murders that the police had not released to the press, and he couldn't account for his whereabouts on either of the days that the girls were murdered. So police obviously became immediately suspicious of Richard. According to author Jeffrey Wambau, Richard had a reputation in the village of enjoying scaring teenage girls as they were walking home from school. And so it seemed like he was a little shit and a 17-year-old boy who liked to torment girls. After 15 hours of interrogation by the police, Richard confessed to the murder of Dawn Ashworth, but he denied killing Linda Mann. The police arrested him, but they felt that he was lying about Linda. They were sure he had killed both, because they were certain that the same man had killed both of the girls. At a nearby university, the University of Leicester, I hope I'm saying that right, Dr. Alec Jeffries, a professor, had been working on hereditary diseases when he accidentally discovered something called DNA or genetic profiling. The police decided to try and cement the case against Richard, so they went to Jeffries with the two semen samples and some of Richard's blood and asked him to positively identify Richard as the killer of both Dawn and Linda. But Jeffries wasn't certain that he could do what the police were asking him to do because it had never been done before. The technique that Jeffries discovered for identifying characteristics in DNA is called RFLP or restriction fragment length polymorphism. Basically, this technique can identify an individual by using just a tiny amount of their DNA. The basic concept of DNA is that it is like a computer program for making a human being. There are no two humans that have the same identical DNA except for identical twins. So by using the DNA found on both Dawn and Linda, the police would literally have a fingerprint of the murderer. Then they could compare Richard's DNA to that DNA of the murderer and see if it was Richard who left the semen sample on the two girls. It took a while, but Jeffries finally completed the process. He discovered that both Dawn and Linda had been raped by the same man, but he couldn't tell the police that it was that man who murdered the girls, although the police were making that leap that whoever raped the girls had also killed them. But when comparing Richard's DNA to that of the man who raped the girls, it was completely different. Meaning Richard didn't rape either Dawn or Linda. And by using the police's conclusions, Richard didn't murder either of the girls. The conclusion was a huge blow to the police because they were convinced that Richard had committed both the murders. and he had confessed to murdering Dawn. I would say that the police had a little tunnel vision going on. Now remember, this was the very first time that a genetic profile had ever been created. So there was a lot of healthy skepticism. At first, the police didn't believe the results that Jeffrey was giving them. Jeffrey's was quoted as saying, "They didn't believe a word we were saying to them." And that was quite right. A healthy skepticism of a new technology. And indeed, I didn't believe the results myself. So Jeffries retested the samples over and over again. And he also sent all the samples out to an independent laboratory. But the same results were found over and over and over again. That being, both of the girls were raped by the same man, and that man was not Richard Buckland. It took about 4 months for all the testing to be finally completed. But when all the testing was completed and placed in front of the police, they had no option but to release Richard from jail. Meaning Richard was the very first person to be exonerated of murder by way of DNA profiling. Without the DNA profiling, Richard would have been jailed for life. But why would Richard confess to something he didn't do? Now remember, Richard has learning disabilities, and this is back in the 80s that he was labeled like that. So chances are he probably had some type of mental disability. He's quoted in an interview after being released as saying, quote, "The pressure started getting really hard. I just didn't have a chance," unquote. After 15 hours of interrogation and having a mental disability, the kid probably figured he was screwed and had absolutely no way out. But the police felt that Richard had probably come upon Dawn's body at some point because he knew information that hadn't been released to the press and that only the killer would know. He knew what her clothing was, where Dawn's body was exactly, and what position she was in, and he knew all about the ligature around her neck. My guess is he came upon her body while he was walking to work on the footpath, and it scared the shit right out of him, and he ran into work and never told a soul. So now what? The police had lost their only suspect. So Detective David Baker, the lead on the investigation into the murder of both the girls, decided that he would go on a DNA manhunt. The police sent letters to all men who were between the ages of 13 and 33 and lived in either the village of Narborough or the village of Enderby. In the letters, the police asked each man to voluntarily submit a blood and saliva test. I find this a fascinating piece of police work. They have the fingerprint of the human who murdered and raped the girls. So now they're going to voluntarily ask men to come in, and that way they can eliminate people. And once you eliminate all the men between 13 and 33 that lives in either of the villages, you should be left with a small pool of suspects that you can then start observing and find out if they might be the ones. Now, remember, the DNA only told the police who raped the girls. But if we remember back to Linda's case, Linda was raped after she was murdered. Meaning, the chances are the person who raped her also killed her. And since it's the same man that raped Dawn who raped Linda, you know it's the same man that murdered both of them. So what were the police thinking? Did they think that the killer would actually submit his blood for voluntary testing? I think they thought he would. Remember, back in the 80s, DNA profiling, or even DNA for that matter, was virtually unknown to the general public. So there's a pretty good chance that he would give his blood and saliva, and that he wouldn't think that it would lead the police to him. More than 5,000 men came forward and submitted their samples. First, they tested the blood type. About 10% of the men who submitted their samples had the same blood type as the killer. That 10% was then sent on for genetic profiling and comparison. But there was one man who worked at a local bakery who didn't offer up a sample. A 27-year-old married man with two children named Colin Pitchfork. Pitchfork was well known in the village. He worked at a local bakery called Hampshire's Bakery, and he also had a side business of making cakes for people. So many, many people between the two villages had had dealings with Colin Pitchfork, you know, for birthdays, weddings, anniversaries, and so on. The police conducted house-to-house searches in Narborough and Enderby. It was during this house-to-house search that Pitchfork came into contact with police for the first time in the Linda Mann murder. His wife Caroline answered the door and let the police in. Pitchfork took his time to come down and speak with the officers. When he did, he told the police officers that he had been replacing the floorboards in the spare room. Police asked him where he was on the night of November 1983. He told the police he was looking after his children, as his wife would have been taking classes at a gym. His wife corroborated the alibi for him. The police officers who interviewed Pitchfork during this house-to-house search stated that there was no indication to them that they were speaking with anyone different than any other father of two. But Colin Pitchfork was actually known to police. He had had convictions for indecent exposure when he was younger. But even that didn't raise any red flags for the police. While at work at the bakery, the co-workers were chatting about the voluntary sample and the murders. Many of the men who lived in the village had already donated their blood to the investigation. But Colin hadn't, and told his co-workers that he didn't want to be involved with the police in any way. So he decided that he would just avoid giving his blood. But then later, Pitchfork realized that by not submitting to the sampling, he looked guilty. So he approached a co-worker of his, Ian Kelly, and was able to convince Kelly to take the blood test for him. Pitchfork told Kelly that he had already given blood for someone else who couldn't go because he was wanted by police. So Pitchfork needed Kelly to pretend he was Pitchfork and give his blood, otherwise Pitchfork would be suspected of the murders. Kelly believed Pitchfork's lie and agreed to give a blood sample and pretend he was actually Pitchfork. But there was a snag. The police were asking for photo ID from each man before they gave the samples. So they had to create some ID that showed that Kelly was Pitchfork. So these two geniuses went down to the mall and used a photo booth. You know the ones that people use at weddings now? Well, they used to be in all the malls. I don't know if they still are. They should be. They were fun. Pitchfork then took his own passport, slit the plastic coating over top of the picture with a razor blade, slid his own photo out, and replaced it with the photo booth picture of Kelly in its place. It was a foolproof plan, at least in Pitchfork's mind anyways. You see, Ian Kelly lived outside of Narborough and Enderby, and he hadn't been asked to take the test. So Kelly was to say he was Pitchfork and the police wouldn't know. Unfortunately, the police officers collecting the samples didn't notice that the picture had been replaced in the passport. So we can now add forgery to the list of crimes for these two shit puppets. Once the 5,000 blood samples had been tested, not one matched the profile of the murderer. So David Baker's brilliant plan of doing a DNA roundup hadn't worked. Which sucks, because I really liked that idea. That was a great idea. But then, 1 year after Don was murdered, Kelly was at a pub with some of his co-workers for a few drinks after work. As the pints went down, a conversation about the DNA manhunt came up. One of his co-workers, a young woman, overheard Kelly bragging to another co-worker that he had actually taken the blood test for Colin Pitchfork. She thought to herself, there's just something not right about that. It didn't make sense to her that someone who was afraid of the police and was innocent of the murders would get someone else to take the blood test for them. So she called the police and told them what she had heard in the pub. You know, someone always has one too many wobbly pops and all of a sudden their lips just start flapping. The police immediately zeroed in on Colin Pitchfork. They took him in for questioning and asked him about the blood test and asked him what he knew about Dawn and Linda's murders. After just a few hours, Pitchfork confessed to killing Dawn and Linda. He knew he was caught and there was no way out, so his only option was to confess. You see, Pitchfork had been following the news stories about the DNA profiling and he actually believed in it. Which is why he knew he couldn't take the blood test and why he needed someone to pose as him. When they tested his DNA, it was a perfect match to the DNA profile for the man who raped Dawn and Linda. So without Jeffrey's accidental discovery, Pitchfork most likely wouldn't have been caught. He had no ties to the girls. He literally sat in wait for a girl to come along the path alone and then attacked. As well, he definitely would have continued to escalate in his crimes. He had already escalated from indecent exposure to rape and murder, which is a big leap to make. There's usually a few stepping stones in between that before you get all the way up to murder. I personally wonder if Pitchfork has victims that just haven't been found. He was also able to keep his wife completely in the dark about his crimes. She had no idea what her husband was. In fact, Pitchfork was able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. None of his friends, family, or acquaintances knew anything about the true monster he was. One disgusting piece of this whole thing is that when Pitchfork was attacking the girls, he had his child with him because his wife was at the gym. He took his child to the murder and rape of these two girls. He is an absolute piece of fucking garbage. On January 22nd, 1988, Pitchfork was found guilty of the rape and murders of Dawn and Linda. As well, he became the first person in the world to be convicted in a murder case by DNA profiling. He was sentenced to life in prison. Ian Kelly was convicted of conspiracy to pervert justice and sentenced to 18 months in prison, but it was suspended. Kelly was quoted outside the courthouse after his conviction as stating, quote, "I was wrong for doing what I did," unquote. Gee, you think? So in September of 2001, Pitchfork was granted early parole, but he was arrested and taken back to prison for breaching his parole conditions. He had been caught approaching women on footpaths near to the halfway house where he was ordered to live. A leopard doesn't change their spots. In 2023, Pitchfork came up for parole again, but was denied. However, his attorneys appealed the decision of the parole board, and Pitchfork won that appeal, meaning he won the right to a new parole hearing. And that parole hearing will be held sometime in the near future of 2024. So Colin Pitchfork could possibly be out of jail by the time you're listening to this episode. And that is the complete story of the very first person convicted of murder by DNA profiling. My thoughts. Pitchfork is a shitfuck. after 20 some odd years in prison, he got parole and immediately went back to approaching women on footpaths. So he must have some type of pathology when it comes to footpaths and 15-year-old girls. And I don't think they should let him out in 2024. I think he should stay in jail until he takes his last breath. Because what he did to these two girls was just disgusting. And if it wasn't for Dr. Jeffries, he would have gotten away with it and he would have continued. And I wouldn't be surprised if Pitchfork has other victims that literally just have not been found. This is an amazing case. There's a lot of firsts in it. And I really enjoyed researching it and I enjoyed telling you about it. First conviction, first exoneration, first genetic profiling. It was also the first DNA roundup, which, if you think about it, led to the hereditary profiling that we have now that we're using to catch killers. When you look at all the firsts of this case, it is an extremely important one for the process of justice. Thank you for joining me. If you enjoyed the show, please go over to my Patreon and support me. This is what keeps the lights on and keeps me being able to do what I love doing, bringing you stories of true crime. Enjoy your day today. This has been a Bitter Witness production.